Today we have an encore edition of Yin Radio. It was originally recorded on June 21st, 2008.
Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A.
From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, welcome to Yin Radio. Today's theme is simple. It's basic. It's essential. It's water. We have four water stories for you today. The first is from Africa, where women and girls walk miles for daily drinking water. Then we hear from a river rafter who took a class on the River of No Return. The third is a fictional account of a surfing family. And the last is a quest for answers. We're going to begin today's show with Annie Lennox. This is her version of one of my favorite Talking Heads songs, Take Me to the River.
My money, my cigarettes.
Annie Lennox, Take Me to the River. For starting out our water story show, good way to go. Now we're going to start with installment number one, though. This is called Water Walker. It's by Jessica Partnow. Every day, women and girls in many parts of the world walk miles to collect water. Often it's scarce, it's dirty, and it can cause disease. Jessica Partnow, a reporter with the Common Language Project, traveled to Africa for a series of stories about daily life. And she produced this story, Water Walker, in February 2008. From the Common Language Project at clpmag.org, Jessica Partnow reports.
Dilo Town is a short stretch of thatched huts lining a dirt road in southern Ethiopia. About 32,000 people live in this community. It's 44 miles from the nearest paved road, 9 from the closest man-made well, and 2 days' drive from the capital city, Addis Ababa. We're close to the Kenyan border here, and not much else. By 6 a.m., Fadi Jilo is hard at work.
I wake up early in the morning and I light a fire to make some tea for breakfast.
Fadi is 30 years old and has 3 young children.
Then I clean my house, I have goats, and I take them to pasture. After I take the goats, I go to fetch water.
This is the height of Ethiopia's dry season. Water and pasture for livestock are scarce. Fadi is anxiously awaiting the rains, expected by the beginning of March. For now, with no water falling from the sky, Fadi must make the long walk to haul it from a spring. As I follow her toward the edge of Dilo Town in the pale morning sunlight, we're joined by several other women in colorful sari-like dresses. Each woman is carrying a jerry can, a 5.5-gallon plastic jug. The cans are a crucial commodity. A new one can cost half of a family's annual cash income. As we reach the end of the short dirt path leading out of town, we come to the rim of a deep crater. At the bottom, there's a former salt lake, brown mud crusted over with glistening white salt.
More than 100 women fetch water here every day. Even other women from the surrounding areas come to collect water here.
The spring is a natural pool tucked into the side of the crater. The water is brackish and shared with hundreds of sheep, goats, and cattle. Their waste contaminates the water supply, causing everything from amoebic dysentery and intestinal parasites to scabies and conjunctivitis. Many people here, especially young children and the elderly, suffer constantly from these ailments.
We get very sick from the water here. People have stomachache, diarrhea with blood, even death. About 20 people die here every year.
Boiling would help prevent waterborne illness, but no one here can afford the fuel. Each woman fills her jerry can at the edge of the pool, screwing the lid on over a tiny square of plastic cut from a plastic bag. The extra plastic bolsters the worn threads on the lip of the jar and keeps every drop of water inside. A full jerry can weighs 44 pounds. Fadi struggles to hoist her load up the steep bank of the shallow pool, a bank made steeper every day by dropping water levels. She makes a cushion out of a bright green shawl, which she ties onto the small of her back. The bottom of the jerry can rests on this padding, and she binds the full can to herself with rope made from animal sinews. Imagine strapping 10 2-liter bottles of soda to your back and walking straight uphill in flimsy plastic sandals.
We're walking up a very steep, rocky slope. All of them, except for the 11-year-old and the 13-year-old, have 20 liters of water on their back. For me, carrying 1.5 liters is exhausting.
Fadi and the other women make this trek 3 times a day. Their walk is only 1.5-hour round trip, shorter than in some areas, but it's long enough for the women to get hurt.
People break their bones, they dislocate their joints, and the problem is worse when we go to fetch water when it is dark. One woman fell down while she was pregnant and she lost the baby.
There is hope for water in Dilo Town. The government says it plans to start work on bringing piped water to Dilo next year. But Fadi doubts that will happen.
We have applied so many times for help, for them to provide us with a water system, but nobody responds to us. They have promised us so many times, but they haven't done anything.
Fadi's life would change dramatically with regular access to safe water. Her daughters would be able to go to school every day, something they can't do now since school shuts down when there's no water. And Fadi would be able to spend more time tending livestock and earning money for her family. Till then, she waits for the three-month-long rainy season, when her water walks will stop for a while. Or so she hopes. A recent UN report says global warming is intensifying droughts in Ethiopia. And Fadi says that lately the rains in Dilo have only been lasting half as long as they used to. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jessica Partnow.
Funding for this report was provided by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
Water is like a washing machine. It keeps the inside and the outside of your body clean. You need plain old water, six glasses a day, so you don't shrivel up and fade away. You can sip it through a straw, you can slurp it from a cup, but you need a lot of water, better drink it all up.
And that's our topic today, water stories. Installment number two is Swift Water Safety by Andrea Clark Mason. Andrea Clark Mason is a writer. She's on the faculty of Washington State University. Early in her instructional career, she trained to be a whitewater raft guide on the Salmon River, the famous River of No Return. Every English major needs something to fall back on. Andrea plunged into the training thoroughly, so she started with an optional high-level course called Swift Water Safety. This installment of Yin Radio is an excerpt from an essay that she wrote and read at the Silos Cafe in Moscow, Idaho, on April 18, 2008. First, Andrea explains the context, and then she reads her essay, Swift Water Safety. Here's Andrea Clark Mason.
So I'm going to start about a third of the way through this essay titled Swift Water Safety. And as Bob said, I'm from Philadelphia. And here are a few things that are in the essay before we get to this point. When I moved west, I had what I think of as an arsenal of Western fantasies about who I would become when I moved west. And what I would look like, what I would do with my time, etc. And one of those things was becoming a rafting guide. I'd gone rafting when I was 14 with my family on the Salmon River in near Stanley, Idaho, and that's how I first came to know Idaho. I don't think I knew where it was before that, but I fell in love. And one summer several years ago, I decided to try this out, to try to become a weekend rafting guide. And the day before the start of the Swift Water Safety course, which was kind of an optional safety course to take before the guide training started, my boyfriend at the time dumped me. And there's a flashback that takes place shortly into the reading, so if you notice it's a different setting, that's what's going on. There's a blank space to indicate that in the essay. In my borrowed booties, helmet, gloves, several layers of fleece, splash jacket, and over top of that, my new hot pink life jacket, I follow the boys. The boys in their dry suits, the boys who are mostly younger than me, stronger than me, shorter than me, and not crying. I follow the boys knowing that in their $600 dry suits, they will not feel the chill of the melted mountaintop snow. They are spots of blue and yellow, shocking against the gray, brown, and dull green of the landscape. I follow them as they descend a gravelly bank overgrown with shrubs to the shore of the river, the vast, swift-moving river, 100 wide yards of brown, smooth, beautiful water. Sam asked at the initial interview, "So, you like to raft?" She held a clipboard and pen in hand, her strawberry blonde curls bobbing. I nodded enthusiastically. I thought of our family trip down the river 14 years earlier, lazy stretches of calm water, my skimpy bikini, a cold can of root beer in my hand, life jacket unzipped, no booties, no helmet. I was also a rower on my high school crew. That was on a polluted flat river in Philadelphia, but I also rode through a few class 2 and 3 rapids on a trip down the Snake River with friends. Then I was successful, steering the raft through rapids with oar strokes that felt familiar. Also, perhaps I was young enough then, 22, not to care what might have happened if I was not successful. "We'll teach you everything you need to know," she said confidently. To pass the course, a whitewater rescuer has to be able to throw, coil, and throw a rescue rope in 45 seconds. David stands behind us and off to one side, clicking his stopwatch. I can't not think about William, his skin, his scent, how he doesn't want to be with me anymore. I throw the rope at the imaginary target and then coil it, tears sliding down my cheeks. The cold, slick rocks, the wide, rushing river, would it be so bad to give up and drive home? What prevents me? My mother's voice saying it would build character. She also paid the $200 to take the course. But I have enough character, and the $200, she'd understand. But then I return to the unchanging fact that I need a distraction, and this is a good one. We live 3 blocks apart, and when I arrive home, all I will want is to see him, for him to tell me he's changed his mind. And he won't have. Of course he won't have. That's what he meant when he said he was sure. That's what he meant when he said he was sorry. Like everyone else, I am throwing and coiling my yellow nylon rope, neon, against the cool brown of the river. Throw, coil, throw, coil. I take a deep breath and dive off the rock into the water. I want to prove myself, to show I'm strong, that I'm not the crybaby and confused knot tire I've been all morning, that I can withstand a breakup and then swim down the swollen middle fork of the Salmon River, that I have stamina. The water is cold, but the first thing I feel is the rushing current, moving and breathing, bigger than anything I have ever known. It pulls me. I try to show the group on shore that there are some things I can do. I can swim. I swim as hard and fast as I can out into the river. David, on shore in his yellow dry suit, is shouting and waving one arm, but I can't hear him. I know I'm farther out in the river than the boys were, but the current has paralyzed me. I lie on my back, my feet pointing downstream, my arms sculling, defensive swimming position, all I can remember of the talk. When I reach the buttress of the bridge, I push off with tennis-shoed feet. I miss the hole, but I do not miss the white water, which covers my head. I look up and see white. I'm swallowing water. The current envelops me, trying to sweep me into the middle of the river. I see the yellow ropes lingering on the water's surface, but they are too far away, and the current drags me swiftly, efficiently past each of them. We have already learned the cardinal rule. You are responsible for your own rescue. When the tall boy with the long blonde hair tosses the last rope, adrenaline courses through my body as I swim as hard as I can towards it. As soon as my hands touch the rope, I hold on tight until I'm out of the current. He starts to coil the rope, signaling me to let go, but I say, "No, can't I just stay here?" Between labored breaths, as I hang there in the water clutching the rope, I notice my knuckles are white. When I finally climb onto the rock, my limbs still shaking, my breath still rattling and heavy, I hear David saying, "Andrea, you are too far out." So that my chest can feel less constricted, I start to unzip my life jacket until David says, "Don't ever unzip your life jacket." Well, the next person is going, probably a boy with 8 years of rafting experience. David approaches me and leans over, his face close to mine, as I sit, still panting, on one of the rocks. "Didn't you hear me or see me waving? You were too far out." "I couldn't hear you," I say, gulping air. "Why didn't you come further in?" He glances now and then at the boy who's smiling and swimming not too hard for any of the yellow ropes near him. "I couldn't," I say, my breath still wheezing and labored. "What do you mean you couldn't? Don't you remember what we talked about on the bridge? I couldn't remember, I say, my breath finally regaining some sense of normalcy. You panicked, he says, standing up. And you know what will happen if you panic while you're guiding? The people in your boat will panic, and there will be death. It's clear he's trying to scare me into paying attention, but at that very moment, he doesn't make me want to try harder. Perhaps the fact that I am in my late instead of my early 20s is sufficient edge on maturity to know I'm not immortal. Perhaps, unlike these other seasoned beer-guzzling guides, I know I will die, and I don't want it to be this summer. Later that summer, someone would die on that stretch of that river, an accounting professor at University of Idaho. His dog, outfitted with a life jacket, would swim his 7-year-old daughter to safety. In that moment, my fantasies of lazy afternoons full of bikinis and beer have turned to thoughts of lawsuits and drowned grandmothers. We had 3 more scenarios that afternoon: swimming over a strainer, rescuing an unconscious person trapped on a rock offshore, and capsizing and then uprighting a wooden boat called a dory. I swim over the half-submerged log. I help, as much as 10 boys in their early 20s will let me, rescue the unconscious person, David, off the rock. I do not help capsize or upright the dory. Still shivering in my wetsuit, I watch each pair of people go out, rowing the dory 30 feet or so offshore and then capsizing it, uprighting it and rowing it out for a short ride in the current before coming back in. Each pair is all smiles as they row, and although the scene is stunning, the late afternoon sun casting through ponderosa pines, I remember the chill of the water, the pull of the current, how hypnotic the river looked when I dove in. How could anything so beautiful be so dangerous? That night, we meet up at the rafting company headquarters, a 2-story house with an office and supply downstairs, and a house upstairs, where the owner of the company lives in the summer. Upstairs, the boys from my class are making tacos. Girls my students' age wear midriffs, drink Milwaukee's Best, and watch Dumb and Dumber. The room looks uncomfortably like the scenes in college I tried my best to avoid. I sit in a chair in the corner. The guys and the girls are flirting about who's having a party when. I imagine in a month or two how it will be just like summer camp. Everyone will be asking who slept with whom, and at some point, one of the guys my student's age will make it a mission to get romantic with the WSU instructor. Eventually, David shows up, Sam tagging along behind him. This morning, they arrived at the park together as well, each with takeout breakfast from a restaurant. I suppose I have no reason to know if they're dating, but in this culture, a few casual nights together seems like an accepted practice. David congratulates everyone on a good day. I wonder if that includes my lecture about panic and death. He asks if everyone has eaten, looking specifically at me. I nod, even though I've only been able to stomach a few bites of the hot sandwich I ordered at the restaurant. David announces we will be watching a DVD called Swept Away. I am the only one who has a pen and paper out for taking notes. A healthy-looking woman in her mid-30s with shoulder-length auburn hair comes on screen. She wears a hard hat and a life preserver. She talks about the many reasons people might be watching this film. She discusses the casualties that happen yearly, resulting from poor decisions, panic, and ill-preparedness. While in back of her flows what looks like a shallow, bubbling stream on a beautiful spring day, she calmly informs us how every year people die in swift water from asphyxiation. She tells us about how they swim for a while, swallow some water, breathe in some water, then, in panic, breathe in more water and drown. The film then cuts to several scenes of city police wearing dress shoes and no life preservers, trying to rescue citizens from flash floods. Sirens ring and images of white sheets draped over stretchers fill the screen. Between each cautionary tale, the woman narrates instructions for tying different knots. Although I dutifully copy the pictures, I know the directional figure eight and the double figure eight on a bite will still elude me tomorrow. The last section of the film shows whitewater adventures in rafts. David pauses the film. What's wrong with this picture? I have no idea, but everyone else does. The boat is overloaded, the boys say, between bites of taco. David nods and resumes the movie. No matter how hard she tries, David continues, the guide is too small to turn the boat. We watch as the boat approaches a fork in the river. All the boats go to the right, except the one David has pointed to. The guide paddles furiously to turn the boat, but instead, the boat catches on a rock in the middle of the river. Watch that woman right there, David says, pointing to the screen. As the river sucks the boat's upstream pontoon underwater, the rafters, one by one, fall out of the boat and are carried around the river's bend. Three heads go downstream. The lady David pointed to disappears under a towering wall of logs and debris. One of the rafters is climbing the log jam. Then the videotaper says, "Hold on there, buddy. Keep climbing. I'm coming to get you." The cut stops. David pauses the film before the next knot-tying instruction. There was a huge lawsuit over that, and it was 6 months before the water was low enough to retrieve that woman's body. I imagine if that was my mother, my sister, me, if I was that guide. That's a shady company, one of the boys says. It was in Washington, near the Cascades. The water was freezing. I heard about that. The name is rubbed out, but I know who it was. Totally shady company, always overloaded their boats, had a buddy who worked for them. The lady by the pastoral stream reviews the basics. Reach, row, throw, go, helo, always wear a personal flotation device. You are your own rescuer. The film is over, there's 1 day left to the course.
You're listening to an encore edition of Yin Radio from June 21st, 2008. The topic is water stories. Installment number 3 out of 4 is Sharkbait by Anna Fortner. Sharkbait's a term that's used in the Pacific Islands for non-islanders. It's not a nice, friendly term. In this piece, author Anna Fortner reads from her story of a dad and a daughter, native Hawaiians. This excerpt is when the father-daughter pair are divided by their different values. Anna, the author, is a UI graduate in creative writing, and she writes fiction and teaches in Santa Barbara, California. Here's Anna Fortner reading a portion of her story, Sharkbait.
I'm riding from my mom's house to my dad's a few miles down the Kapuli Highway. I have flip-flops on even though I'm on my bike. Mom is always telling me I'm going to lose a toe in the spokes, and I keep telling her if she buys me a car for my 16th birthday, she won't have to worry anymore. Dad, though, could care less what I wear on my feet. But better than being allowed to wear flip-flops on my bike is the fact that it's the beginning of Christmas break and the start of my week with Dad. And according to him, chores and homework always come after surfing. Dad is ready in his usual pair of faded red board shorts, and his hair is pressed flat against his head because he always wears a broad canvas hat to shade out the sun while he works in the orchards. Dad sits at the table and pulls the cuff of an electric blood pressure monitor from his upper arm. About a month ago, a friend of his had to have bypass surgery. Even though my dad has never had any health problems, it scared the crap out of him, so he went to the doctor, who told him he had high blood pressure and put him on medication. The medication made Dad sleepy and dizzy, though, so he stopped taking it and became a health nut. He'll be 45 in a couple days and looks better than ever. His stomach doesn't stick out so much, and his shoulders and biceps are hard, as if instead of bone and muscle under his skin, Dad has mangoes, which might not be that far from the truth, since it's all he's been eating lately to keep his sodium intake low. "Hey, Kiki, come here," Dad says. He takes a slice of mango from the plate next to him. I sit down and wait for him to finish chewing. "Okay," he says, wiping his hands on his shorts. He sticks out his tongue, round and hard, through pursed lips, and tries to mumble something around it. "What?" He pulls his tongue in. "Is my tongue bright red?" It is, and I tell him so. "What about now?" He opens his mouth wide and lays his tongue flat against his chin. Still red, I tell him. But is it bright? Yes, it's still bright. Yep, he says that's why my acupuncturist says I have rocket fuel in my veins. He only sees people like me once every 3 years. I'm so healthy he doesn't know what to do. Well, I guess that's good. Of course it is, he says. He sucks the last traces of a mango's flesh from its seed. How you think the surf's gonna be this afternoon? I walk to the sliding glass door and look past the stretch of green lawn and the hedges of gardenias to the ocean. Though we rarely surf the break behind the house in the winter because it's all closeouts, I can still tell how it's going to be at Hanalei Bay by the looks of the swell here. The ocean is choppy and full of whitecaps, and the shore break is big. Each wave sends a spray of white foam 10 feet into the air. Good, I tell him. It's going to be good. Well, all right then, he says, tossing the mango seed into the trash. I'm tired of small surf. We need something to weed out the shark bait. I roll my eyes. I walk to my bedroom and change into my swimsuit. I can't decide if I should bring a wetsuit, so I slide open the door leading to the backyard and step outside. The offshore wind is strong but warm. When I was little, I swam here often. I timed the fall of each wave so that I could dive under in time and watch, the salt water stinging my eyes, as the sand beneath me boiled up and was swept away by the pool of the ocean as a wave rolled back down the sloped shore and out to sea. When Dad got home from work, he'd always take me swimming on his back out to where the waves were breaking and tread water until a wave stood before us. He'd take my hands from his neck and pull me in front of him, and as the wave rose, so did we, and then it would tube over our heads. I'd squeal and ask, "Is this what it's like?" And Dad would smile and laugh and nod his head. "Yes," he'd say, "only better." I turn from the water and see my dad standing at the back door. "Hey, Kai," he calls, "come here." He is holding a stethoscope and a manual blood pressure cuff. "I want you to take it, just to see if what you get is different," he says. "What, is it high?" "Maybe," he says. "I never know if I can trust the electronic reading. Just take it so I can know for sure." He sits on the edge of the deck and I place the cuff around his arm and adjust the earpieces until they dull the drumming of the wind. This is one of the few useful things I learned in the first aid class Mom made me take last summer after my friend Marika broke her arm when we were surfing together. At 170 millimeters mercury, I slowly release the cuff and wait to hear the steady beating of Dad's heart. The needle passes 160 and 155 in silence and I am relieved. At 150, I hear the first thump. But I know Dad is watching my face, so I don't even blink, because I know a reading much above 130 over 80 will upset him, and he won't listen when I tell him it's high, only because he makes it so with all his worrying. He'll nod like he's listening, but spend the rest of the day lost in his head and only going through the motions of surfing. I hear the last beat at 90 and open the valve all the way. I pull the cuff from his arm. 132 over 80, I lie. Nothing to worry about. I tuck my board under my arm and push my bike from the side of the house. Dad is already riding in circles in the middle of the street. I follow him out onto the road that cuts through the heart of Hanalei. We pass the coffee depot and Dad inhales deeply. God, I miss it, he says. Hanalei has been filling up the last few years with all kinds of hippies and rich mainlanders who can afford the crazy expensive houses being remodeled on all the beachfront property that locals have given up. Dad's neighbors sold their home to a vacation rental place and moved inland. Whenever it's rented out, Dad stands at the fence watching the vacationers through the space between the slats and complains aloud, even if no one is there to listen, about the noises their children make or the smoke from their bonfires that blows into his bedroom, even the way he has to avoid their fishing lines when he goes for a run on the beach. They aren't satisfied with crowding our waves, he always says. Now they want our homes, too. When I saw Dad standing at the fence a couple weeks back, I suggested that maybe if he paid the tourists less attention, they wouldn't bother him so much, and he said, "It's not me I'm worried about. It's you and your children and your children's children. Where are you going to live when all of Kauai has been rented out? I worry for your sakes." "Well, don't," I said. "Me and my children's children don't want your heart attack on our consciences." Then he got really mad. "Don't tell me my daughter is one of those." He stuck his finger in my face and his cheeks turned red. "One of those what?" I asked. "A kama'aina who doesn't care for her people or their ways." I pushed his finger out of my face. I returned to Mom's early that week. In the parking lot closest to the point break at Hanalei, there are a handful of surfers, including Petey, sitting on drop tailgates. When Petey notices us, he saunters over. Dad and I climb off our bikes and I lock them to a tree. "Hey, Ali'i," Petey says. He pushes his dark sunglasses on top of his head and takes Dad's hand in his, pulling him into a hug. I roll my eyes. "And look who you have with you," Petey adds, "a wahine." "Shut up," I tell him. "What?" he says, his hands on his chest. "Don't pull that Hawaiian warrior crap around me. My dad is not your chief, and you don't call me wahine." Dad laughs, just an exhale pushed out his nose. I don't think he's sure whose side to take. Petey snickers. "Got some shark bait this afternoon," he says to Dad. "Check it out." Petey points to the small break along the pier where some tourists are learning to surf. They paddle any time there's the slightest hint of a wave, and when they try to stand up, they're always too far back or too far forward on the board, so they fall off almost immediately. Some of them don't even realize how close they are to shore, so they fall into the water like it's deep, butt or head first, and hit sand only 10 inches down. When one of them trips on his leash, Petey and the kids on the tailgates laugh and point and jeer, and Dad chuckles under his breath. "Any outside?" Dad asks, motioning with his head to the big break further out. "Nah, not right now." We watch the shiny peaks of the waves approach the point, growing in height until they crash over onto themselves. "I'll wax," I say. I carry the boards to the lawn and lay them down next to each other. From my pocket, I pull a chunk of wax and rub it along the surface of the boards. When I'm done, I kick off my flip-flops by the bikes and carry Dad's board to him. I wade into the water with my surfboard under my arm. When the water grows deep and I can no longer touch bottom, I climb on and begin to paddle. At the point, I watch a wave roll in and pitch up to a solid 12 feet. A surfer screams down its face. Adrenaline tingles in my arms and legs. I paddle to the line of white foam left by the previous wave and sit up to scan the horizon. The next wave looks like it's going to be a big one. I scoot myself back on my board, and when it reaches me, I stand and feel the pull of gravity, the loss of my stomach. At the bottom, I whip my board around and ride back to the crest of the wave. More of the wave is crashing onto itself, so I make a few turns and slow until I am in the pocket. Then I squat down with my butt on the backs of my legs and let the water crash onto my back. On the way back out, I watch the waves for a sign of Dad, but it is not until I reach the break again that I see him. He straddles his board and pokes at a spot in his left armpit. I paddle over and ask what he's doing. "I'm sore," he replies. A perfectly good wave rolls underneath him. "Well, you're digging at your armpit. Of course it hurts." Normally he laughs when I say stuff like this, when I tell him like it is, but this time he just gives me a sad smirk. I wonder if he thinks I sound like Mom. We watch the second wave stand up. "Come on," I tell him. Dad lies across his board and starts to paddle. Before he's made it 5 feet, though, he sits up, his right hand pressed hard against his chest. I paddle closer and Dad places his other hand on my shoulder and squeezes tightly. "You okay?" I ask, but he's just staring at me, hardly breathing. "Say something." He squeezes my shoulder tighter and shakes his head. Panic catches in my throat like vomit. I look around for someone, but find only the rising shoulder of a wave coming towards us and the back of one beyond us, and I see, as if in a dream, the two of us floating way out in the ocean, far from anyone. "Wait," Dad wheezes, "it's getting better." We sit silently until Dad is taking in air in forced gulps. "We need to get you to the hospital," I say, tears piling behind my eyes. "Can you make it to shore?" "I don't know," he whispers. "I have an idea." I take Dad's wrist and Velcro my leash around it, then coil the plastic rope until there's about a foot between the end of my board and his hands. "Hold on tight," I say, and start paddling. We pass a surfer we don't know on his way back out to the break. "You trained her well," he jokes to Dad. My arms burn from the effort, and it makes me angry because I feel like this is my fault, and the least I can do is get him to the hospital quickly. By the time we reach shore, Dad is pale and struggling for air again. I put his arm over my shoulder and walk him to our bikes. "Sit here," I tell him. "I'll call 911. "No, don't," he says. "Please." "Dad, forget the rocket fuel in your veins. Something's wrong." He cringes as if I've just slapped him. He looks out into the water. "Please, just give me a minute." "This is ridiculous. Just wait, Kiki." He's got his right hand over his heart. I'm scanning for a payphone when Petey emerges from the water. Can you give us a ride to the hospital, I ask. My dad is having a heart attack. Petey's eyes grow wide. What? We need a ride. Now. Yeah, of course, Petey says, looking from me to dad to me. Just a sec. He turns and runs to his truck. Kai, I asked, dad starts. I interrupt him. Is what Petey thinks of you really more important than getting you to the hospital? He doesn't say anything. Petey flies from the far side of the dirt parking lot, a cloud of dust kicking up behind his truck, and stops in front of us. Come on, Ellie, he says. He climbs out to help me get Dad to his feet. I'm fine, Dad says, shaking us off. Halfway to the car, he grabs his chest again. I grab Dad's waist, and Petey puts his hands on Dad's shoulders. I've got him, I say. No, you don't, Petey says. He's too heavy. No, he's not, I say, but Petey doesn't let go. I'm fine, Dad says again. Let go. He pushes at our hands until we do. At the hospital, Petey pulls in front of the door to the ER and stops. I'll get a doctor, he says, and rushes inside. Come on, I say, grabbing hold of Dad's legs and turning them towards the door of the truck. The doctor looks young, perhaps not more than 30. His scrubs have a faint floral pattern on them. He asks Dad if his chest or left arm hurts and listens to Dad's heart with his stethoscope. So, you guys out surfing, he asks. Dad doesn't say anything, so I tell him yes. Any good? Not bad, I say. I just moved here from Michigan with my wife. We're taking lessons. It's surprisingly difficult. I cringe, but when I turn and see Petey standing shirtless with his back against the wall and goosebumps sprouting on his arms, he doesn't look menacing at all. We're going to give you a nitroglycerin pill, the doctor continues, and it's very important for you to tell us if it seems to make the chest pain go away. Its effects, if any, should be almost immediate. A nurse places an oxygen tube in Dad's nose. Okay, he says. The doctor leaves and I walk to Dad's side. How is it now, I ask. I put my hand on his shoulder. All right, he says. Another nurse sticks an IV into his arm. Here you go, the doctor says, and hands Dad the pill. We watch him swallow it. Well, I ask. I don't know. He's grimacing in concentration. Outside, there's the shriek of sirens. What about now, I ask. I can't tell, Dad says. Well, actually, maybe, yes, it's making the pain go away, I think. He's looking at the doctor, his eyebrows arched. I'll give you a minute, the doctor says, and leaves again. You really can't tell, I ask. Well, I can breathe better, but my chest is still tight. Does that mean it's working? Yes, it must be, I say. After a few minutes, the doctor returns and asks Dad if he's feeling any better. I think so, Dad says. Well, we're going to do some more tests to confirm a heart attack. A nurse with a plastic tray full of syringes comes to take some blood, then an x-ray technician wheels Dad away. You're cold, Petey says. He hasn't moved from his place against the wall. I look down at my own body and see he's right. I'm covered in goosebumps, too. Thanks, I tell him, for the ride. No problem. He kicks off his flip-flop and rubs the bottom of his foot against his leg. You should probably go, though, I say. He looks at me. I'll be right back, he says. I watch a couple of paramedics wheel by an old woman with long gray hair, then a young boy with his leg in a splint. Eventually they roll Dad back in. He's got the blanket up to his chin, and his eyes are wet and red. The doctor says the blood work was negative for some enzyme that would indicate a heart attack, but that they're still waiting on the x-rays. I can't believe it isn't a heart attack, and I'm worried they might be wrong, so when the doctor turns to leave, I tell him to wait. This afternoon I took my dad's blood pressure and it was high, I say. No, it wasn't, Kiki, Dad says. Yes, it was. I lied to you. It was 150 over 90. He looks confused. Do you always lie to me when you take it? No, I tell him, not always. The doctor clears his throat. 150 over 90 isn't very high, and it certainly isn't indicative of an impending heart attack. I feel better, but only for a second, because when I look at Dad, he's staring at his hands like maybe they can tell him why I lied. I'm sorry, I tell him. He nods, but only slightly, so I know he isn't really listening. The doctor leaves, and I sit in a chair by Dad's bed. We don't talk. The doctor comes back and tells us the x-rays don't reveal anything, but that he'd like to keep Dad overnight for monitoring and to give him a treadmill stress test in the morning. A nurse wheels Dad out of the ER and into a room with two empty beds. The nurse and I help Dad into one of them. Another nurse brings me and Petey blankets. You should go, I tell Petey. We're fine. No, Dad says. I want him to stay. He's staring at his feet, waiting out the silence that settles in the room. I open my mouth to speak, and he says, "You tell lies. Why should I listen to you?"
You're listening to Yin Radio. We have our final installment on this show of water stories coming up for you. Installment number 4, it's Where Does Water Come From? It's by Christy Schwartz. Kids ask a lot of questions. Sometimes they really do want answers, too. And if they don't get them, the questions can hang around, sometimes for a very long time.
Daddy? Where does water come from? I must have been 7 years old when I asked him this question. He paused and looked up in the air, which meant his answer was going to take a long time to surface. My dad often takes long moments like this, which I found frustrating as a child. To avoid annoyment, I would focus my attention to other things, like owls hooting in the darkness and the cool air on my skin. We always seemed to talk more at night. After a moment, he sighed, looked at me and said, "The earth." I stared back at him as if he was a ghost. Was that really his answer? This was really much more basic than I was expecting. "But how?" I asked. Looking back, I suppose I was expecting something similar to Aldo Leopold's poetic rendition of atom recycling in his essay Odyssey. After all, my dad knew everything. "The earth makes it," he shrugged. I could have again asked, "How does it make it?" But I had been down this road with adults several times. I knew eventually the answer would be something like, "It just does," which in adult language translates as, "Give it up, kid. Forget it." This is something I was never very good at. I suppose I'm still not. I realize what frustrated me most about my dad's answer was the simplicity of it. When I left for college, my water question, and many more like it, still nagged at me. I majored in environmental science, where I was able to learn scientific explanations for natural phenomena. I learned about the water cycle and that the earth, skies, and seas reformat atoms into and out of water molecules on a daily basis. I learned that my dad's answer of the earth creating water was not quite accurate. It doesn't create water, because water has always existed, or at least the oxygen and hydrogen that make up water always have. I learned of theories and tools that attempted to explain the world, like the Big Bang, carbon dating, and evolution.
The clouds get heavy and the rain pours down. Precipitation and more puddles on the ground. Oh, the water cycle round and around. Vapor goes up and the rain comes down.
Science has done a beautiful job in explaining complex situations through modeling and theory. What I learned most during my 4-year degree is that I ended with more questions than I started with. The answers I found in science left my soul with an empty feeling. The answers I found in religion left a bitter taste in my mouth and seemed desperately anthropocentric. My original water question hurled me down a spiritual, metaphysical quest that I have still yet to return from. Where does water come from? I recently realized I have been asking the wrong question for the last couple of decades. My question to my father was really not where does water come from, but why does it form? And in the same matter, why do we humans form? To be able to truly answer where water comes from, where this world comes from, we give a person an ability to answer life's deepest creation questions. What or who created this place? How did it get here? When did it happen? Perhaps it was a little unfair of me to expect my dad to have a thorough answer to the mystical nature of our world without advanced warning. Still, my 7-year-old brain is alive and always questioning, even today. Why do we exist? Why am I here? And a million other why questions that adults love to hear. So, Dad, or anyone else that may have an answer, I would love to hear it.
Even a simple answer would be a good place to start.
Water circles, water cycles, water dances, watch it spin. As the water coming to us goes around and round again.
And we're going to wrap up our water stories show with Bonnie Raitt singing about cool, clear water.
Thank you. yourself falling down. Your hopes in the sky, but your heart like grape gum on the ground.
And you. Thanks for joining me for Yin Radio on our Water Stories show. If you'd like to contact Yin Radio, please feel free to do so. You can reach us by email at yinradio, that's Y-I-N radio, at vpfound.org, or call 208-882-1626. I would like to thank for today's show Jessica Parto from the Common Language Project, Andrea Clark Mason, Anna Fortner, and Christy Schwartz. Christy Schwartz helped co-edit two of the pieces on today's show, and Danny Vargas helped with the music. I'm your producer and host, Sandy Billings, and from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Until next week.
Or anyone who cared in the end. That's when everything fades or falls away. Cause the chains which once held us are only the chains which we've made. And when you're standing in the water and you're bailing yourself out of the straw, and when you're to remind, it's nothing without love, 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 it's nothing without love.
This has been an encore edition of Yin Radio's Water Story Show from June 21st, 2008.